The following Politics and Science interview was conducted on September 27th, 2001. Dr. Merrill Nass, thanks so much for coming on Politics and Science. It's an honor to have you here. I've been following your work, I think, for maybe a little over a year and a half now. And I think your biography would be better done by you, if you wouldn't mind just giving the salient details.
Sure. So I'm an internal medicine physician. I'm 70 years old. And when I was in my late 30s and a young physician, I stumbled on, because I lived in Amherst, Mass, and Frances Crowe of the AFSC was nearby, and her husband had founded the Physicians for Social Responsibility chapter in Amherst and Northampton. There were students at UMass who, for a class, were looking into Pentagon contracts at the university and came up with anthrax vaccine contracts and grants. And it turned out that there was a professor there. Later, it turned out there were four professors who had previously worked at Fort Detrick in the biological weapons field for the government. And after that had been changed to biodefense and the United States was no longer producing weapons, that happened in 1975, some people left and became professors. But he was still doing some anthrax work for the Pentagon while at UMass. And I wound up being asked to look at his contracts and his CV and report back to Physicians for Social Responsibility. And I discovered that actually his contracts had nothing to do with anthrax vaccine, but were rather a sort of primitive method of genetic engineering of anthrax. And that was in 1988 or 89. And so I wound up, I felt obliged to write a paper about that and point out what he was doing and that in fact what he and some others who also had Pentagon contracts were doing went against the treaty, the Biological Weapons Convention treaty that had gone into force in 75. And also was not in compliance with Army mission statements, et cetera. The other thing that happened was I decided, well, why do they care about anthrax? I mean, we never even learned about anthrax in medical school. So I decided to look up all the recent anthrax epidemics and see what they looked like and see if maybe there was a reason. Maybe that people were doing biological warfare with anthrax. So I went back 15 years and got all the papers on small anthrax epidemics, except for one which was very large, and looked at them, and I realized immediately that the large one was completely different than all the others, and it looked like it was, in fact, biological warfare, and sure enough, it had happened in the middle of Rhodesia's civil war, and it had been written off as a natural occurrence, but it clearly wasn't. And so I spent 3 years, and there were at least a couple of hundred people who had died from it. So I felt it was important to get the historical record straight and show that it had not been a natural event, and that there were ways that one could look back at an epidemic and figure out whether it was likely to have been natural or deliberately caused. So I wrote a paper on that, and those were sort of, you know, particularly the second was an important paper because no one had ever done that before.
Yeah, that's impressive. Who was the person whose contracts you were looking at so closely?
His name was Curtis Thorne.
Okay. And he, I'm sorry to make you repeat things, but he was a professor at the college you were?
At UMass, at University of Massachusetts, Amherst. Yep, a microbiology professor. But he had contracts that, as I said, claimed they were looking at developing a better anthrax vaccine, but that's not what the body of the contracts had anything to do with. So having discovered that, you know, they were covering up something, I started to dig deeper. At the same time, Frances Crowe, a famous activist at AFSC, got the AFSC Quaker group to put some money into doing this research. and a guy who was later became well known in Massachusetts, Jonathan Boniface. He ran for attorney general in Massachusetts later. John Boniface, at that time, had just graduated from college, and so he was hired to gather information and send out FOIAs, et cetera. So I had, again, this was 1989, when people still thought, you know, you could use the government for good purposes, and, I mean, you could use the FOIA system and other things, and you could talk reasonably to people, and maybe good changes would occur. So, and then the Gulf War came. So I had apparently, you know, preceded that, and I knew a lot about anthrax, and virtually no other civilians did. If you didn't work for an army or for a government bioweapons program, you know, you didn't know about anthrax. So I wound up being a spokesperson for the National Physicians for Social Responsibility, and, you know, just sort of got into that. And then that wound up after the war. I was asked to look into Gulf War syndrome. And then by the end of 1997, the government said they were going to vaccinate everybody in the military for anthrax. And so there were questions about whether that had caused Gulf War syndrome or contributed to it. I don't believe it was the only cause of Gulf War syndrome, but I think it had been a contributor. Turned out, so I started looking more into the actual vaccine. I knew a little about it, but not that much. Turned out it was a really, really bad vaccine. Most of the lots had expired and been redated, usually more than once. There had been bacterial and fungal growth in, you know, millions of vials. It was a mess, and the plant had not been inspected by the FDA in over a decade. So soldiers started getting vaccinated and started getting sick, and then I wound up being very much involved with a large number of military people trying to stop this crazy program, and we did stop it for a while, and then FDA slapped a new license on the vaccine. They built a new plant. The taxpayer paid to build a new plant for a company that had bought the manufacturing facility called Emergent Biosolutions, at that time Bioport, and now with COVID, that company had contracts to make three of the COVID vaccines for the United States, and just like before, they failed. They're the Keystone Cops of vaccine manufacture, so they had many millions of doses that had to be thrown away. They contaminated, mixed up the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines, which were both being made in the same factory. And anyway, they're still around. They're still a player. They're famed for basically using lobbying, which I think is a polite term for bribery, in many cases, and using contacts to get ridiculously profitable contracts with the government. And so they had 9 contracts to make 4 or 5 different vaccines and 4 drugs for COVID. Fortunately, only one is now on the market, as far as I know, which is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
So Emergent Biosolutions is responsible for the Johnson & Johnson?
Correct. They are making all the Johnson & Johnson vaccine now for the U.S.
Oh, wow. I just assumed that was made by Johnson & Johnson.
Right. Yeah. And you would have assumed that the Pfizer vaccine was being made by Pfizer and BioNTech, but it isn't.
Oh, who makes that?
And Moderna, in most cases, these companies have farmed out the manufacture to other companies.
Oh, I see. So they just subcontract to somebody's factory.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And I wonder the quality is still...
Well, that's a very good question.
Yeah. Dr. Nass, could you talk about vaccines in general? Like, I imagine the accusation that hits you most often is that you're anti-vax, because that seems to be like a cliche way to put somebody down. But maybe just talk about the general use of vaccines for fighting disease. What's your feeling about that?
Okay. Well, anti-vax, as you pointed out, is a pejorative term designed to cloak someone with a whole lot of stuff that they may not deserve. Whereas the term breakthrough infections in the vaccinated is a very positive term designed to avoid using the older term, which was vaccine failure, for when someone who has been vaccinated develops the infection they were vaccinated to prevent. So I would just encourage your listeners to think about the language that's being used around COVID and the implications that language is trying to convey. Anyway, so I was fully vaccinated. I didn't know that there was anything wrong with vaccines. You know, in medical school, you get about an hour on vaccines, all the vaccines. Well, of course, there weren't as many, nearly as many, when I went to med school in the 70s, but you really aren't taught anything about the manufacturing, the regulation, et cetera. You're just taught that these are the vaccines and this is when people get them. So it was a bit of a shock to me to find when I was working on Gulf War syndrome and the Gulf War, when I was reading all the anthrax literature in those days, to find that there were real problems with vaccine manufacture and one needed to, you know, turn over a lot of leaves or papers to figure out what was going on in vaccine manufacturing. It's been a sort of an arcane area where very few physicians ever work in it, and you don't realize that the devil is in the details. So the manufacturing plants may have lots of problems, all sorts of different kinds of problems. But the FDA is required by law to examine them every 2 years, but it rarely meets that standard. So maybe the FDA will get to a vaccine manufacturer every 3 years in the U.S., but many of our vaccines now are being made overseas. And before COVID, the FDA would only get to overseas inspections about once every 11 years. And in the U.S., the FDA can just go in and inspect a plant, show up and inspect. But overseas, they actually have to make an appointment. So the facilities can clean up problems in advance when they know the FDA is coming. But since COVID started, I believe the FDA hasn't done a single overseas inspection. And so some companies, you know, understanding this, have, you know, taken a lot of leeway and failed to live up to standards. And some companies have routinely, you know, forged documents or, not forged, but, you know, when they have to do tests at every level of vaccine manufacture, you have to do tests to show that your product is pure, that it's still alive if you have an attenuated virus, and to test for other things. So what happened with anthrax is oftentimes the vaccine would fail these tests, and then the manufacturer would just repeat the tests over and over and over again until they finally got a pass. And then they would write down that result and throw away all the others. And things like that are done, you know, in certain places, certain countries. Catherine Eban wrote a book about generic medicines and how a particular company in India, you know, routinely fudged all this data. She also pointed out that they had sort of two levels of products. They had a level of product that they would make that was of higher quality that would go to Western countries, and a poorer quality that they might be selling to African countries or other Asian countries.
Wow. So do you feel like, it sounds like maybe the laws are adequate to guarantee some modicum of safety, but it sounds like they're not being implemented.
So I think, yeah, I think what you're saying is they're not being enforced.
Yes.
And I think that is a big problem. That's absolutely a big problem. And or the regulatory bodies like the FDA feel that there are so many problems that there are many that they need to overlook. You know, there are minor problems and there are major problems, and they're just going to ignore the minor problems.
Yeah, do you think that's a fallout from basically regulatory capture, and that whereas the industry that's supposedly regulated by these, by the FDA and this, I don't know if the CDC does regulation too, but you know, if the industry has actually started to wag the dog here, it's do you think that's a factor in this?
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, obviously, there's so many examples of regulatory capture in all the sub-agencies of the HHS. There's no question about that. But it's it goes beyond that, because these are all executive branch agencies, FDA, CDC, you know, the different secretaries in HHS. We have an assistant secretary for preparedness and response. You know, we have BARDA, we have DARPA, you know, there are many agencies that work on these, on vaccines.
Yeah.
And so if you're, but you can just lobby the White House, you know, you
I see, it's one-stop shopping, you mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And get what you want. I mean, Biden said, you know, we needed to have mandates and we needed to have a licensed vaccine. And so FDA gave them a licensed vaccine on August 23rd, except, you know, there's very little, possibly none, of that licensed vaccine around. So everybody is still getting the emergency use authorized vaccine, but the mandates are being imposed on the basis that we have a licensed vaccine. So there's a bait and switch, which meant that it appears to have started in the White House, but the FDA and the CDC have gone along with it, no problem.
Yeah.
Two regulators from the FDA put in their resignations, though, at the end of August, and we don't know why, but they were quite high up, maybe, you know, the number two person and her deputy in the Center for Vaccines, the Center for Biologics at FDA. And these are people that have gone along with a lot over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But they have now resigned. So, you know, we don't know. These agencies are fairly opaque in their dealings with the public. But they have been issuing these documents that are more mealy-mouthed, more weasel-worded than normal. I mean, normally they're abstruse. You know, they use, for example, the company that has the product is called the sponsor. If you don't know that, you won't understand the language.
Okay.
Approval means licensed. Authorized means emergency use authorization. You know, these words, and they have, so unless you know the specific meanings of their words, you can't read the documents. But they made very strange documents last month regarding the licensing of Comirnaty, saying, well, you know, we're licensing Comirnaty, but we don't have enough of it yet for everybody, but we have a lot of the EUA product, so they can be used interchangeably. And then in a footnote, it says, but they are legally distinct. That's it. They didn't tell you what the legal distinction was.
Huh.
You know?
That's so confusing.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds intentionally
deliberately confusing.
Yeah. So you can't get the one they licensed, but you can use that license to take the one they have the emergency use authorization for.
Right. And if you take the one that they have the emergency use authorization for, you you are injured by it, you have almost no recourse. There's a terrible program that Congress set up that,
yeah,
probably would not even pass inspection. It hasn't been challenged legally, but there's no due process. Basically, if you get injured, you ask HHS to pay you. At the most, you can collect lost wages and unpaid health care expenses. There's no money for a lawyer. There's no legal process. There's no judge. There's no jury.
Wow.
There's, you know, a bureaucrat within HHS that says you can have money or you can't. And in the 15 years of the program, they've only paid off 29 people.
Is that right?
Yeah.
29 people, but I understand that the settlements that people have gotten total $3 billion or somewhere in that range?
No, no, that's a different program.
Okay.
So this is a much stingier program than that one.
Okay.
This one, they say about 3,000 people have applied to it, and as of the end of August, nobody had gotten any money for a COVID vaccine injury.
Oh, I see. So this is for the recent COVID emergency use.
Yeah, it's okay. Also for anything else that's gotten an emergency use authorization. So that would be products for the swine flu, anthrax vaccine, smallpox vaccine, drugs for those for anthrax and smallpox, etc. So those are special products, and they have this special program, which was enacted when the smallpox vaccine started killing people in 2003, and the healthcare workers said, you know, we're not going to take it. And only 40,000 did. And then the whole program fizzled, because if they were injured, they got no money. So Congress quickly created a program to give people some money, try to get that smallpox thing going again. But it only gave people up to 250,000 was the max, and now it's about 370,000. But almost nobody gets it, because it's only for lost wages and unpaid medical bills, nothing else.
Yeah, and when you're talking serious disability, 250,000 is nothing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, wow. I didn't realize it was a separate court for that.
It's not a court.
Oh, okay. It's not a court.
It's an administrative procedure within HHS. So, and they have to get Congress to allot money to it. So there may not even be any money in the kitty at the moment. We don't know.
Yeah.
So they've actually paid out, as I said, 29 people in 15 years. So it's really tough to get any money out of them. If you're injured, so what's going to happen with Comirnaty? Is because the CDC advisory committee voted to put the vaccine on the childhood schedule, recommending for 16 and 17 year olds, who are the ones Comirnaty was licensed for, 16 and above, it will be put into the National Vaccine Injury Program as a result within the next few weeks or months.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a sort of a court called a vaccine injury court, where there are 9 special masters, and you have the possibility of presenting your case to them.
I see. Are they really called special masters?
They are, yes.
Wow. I've never heard that title before. That's the court that it's awarded $3 billion total?
Yeah, $4 billion now.
Oh, okay, yes. $4 billion. Okay.
Over the 30 years of the program.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit, just to give some people some background of the history of how that court was created and why?
Sure. So let's go back to the original swine flu scare in 1976, when President Ford was in office.
Okay.
There was a soldier who died at Fort Dix, New Jersey, after a forced march. He got some sort of infection, respiratory infection, and he died. And there were some other people at Fort Dix, you know, maybe 10 or 20, who also got the same infection and were not as badly injured. And as has been happening for the last 50 years since this, was same thing was happening beforehand. Oh, my God, you know, it's going to be another 1918 Spanish flu. So the public health agencies of the U.S. got in gear and said, my God, we better come up with a vaccine right away. And I hate to tell you, but bureaucrats are bureaucrats, and if they can expand their empire, they do it, if possible. So the CDC was not a big deal agency in those days. And anyway, a huge program was started, and 4 large vaccine manufacturers were brought in to start developing the swine flu vaccine for everybody. Well, immediately after this poor guy died, there was no more swine flu. It disappeared off the face of the earth.
Huh.
We didn't have it. that they had gotten this program going. And you've got all these bureaucrats, and they just said, let's go with it. So for 6 months, they had their own little warp speed going. And then the vaccine manufacturers, when everybody, you know, and they're telling the United States people, we're going to get this vaccine for you, you know, you're going to be so lucky, the whole thing, you know, the same propaganda as with warp speed. So the manufacturers came back and said, look, our insurance companies are not going to insure us for this. You're going to have to indemnify us. And that had never happened before. And having promised everybody this vaccine that was absolutely unnecessary, the decision was made to indemnify these companies. Well, once you take, so that means they have no liability. If the vaccine doesn't work, no liability. And if the vaccine kills people, no liability. Well, I mean, if you're a manufacturer, you'll make anything anybody wants if you have no liability for the product, and you'll be able to make it very quickly.
Sure.
So that's what they did, and they started vaccinating people, and immediately, practically immediately, because they started the program really about 6 months later, people started getting Guillain-Barré syndrome, getting temporary or permanent paralysis, and there were some other side effects also. And so very quickly, studies were done to try to figure out how common it was to get Guillain-Barré syndrome. And they had, I think, 400 or 500 cases, and about 40 people died from it. They had some other things. They vaccinated a quarter of the U.S. population, which was about 45 million people, for a disease that did not exist. Okay, fast forward 10 years, Reagan is in office, and there are fewer and fewer vaccine companies because in those days they only got, you know, a buck or two for a dose of vaccine. And they're saying it's not profitable, and we're worried about liability, or, you know, Americans are getting more litigious, and we don't like it, and we're going to get out of the business, and so we need something done for us. And so the government came up with this no-fault plan. The federal government basically immunized the manufacturers.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost impossible to sue them. You could still sue them in state court, but so there was this national, what was it called? Anyway, there was a Vaccine Injury Act in 1986. And a system, VAERS, was set up so that the United States government, the CDC and the FDA, were responsible for collecting reports of vaccine injuries. HHS was supposed to start investigating vaccine injuries to find out what they were and how often they occurred, et cetera. And a 25-cent excise tax was placed on every dose of vaccine that would go into a fund to pay for vaccine injuries. And, based off of this 1976 liability waiver that the manufacturers had received, they managed to put this thing in. So almost all the vaccines have been under this program. Once a vaccine is put on, so the sine qua non, what is required to get your liability waived, is your vaccine has to either be put on the childhood schedule or be recommended by CDC for pregnant women.
Okay.
And so you can imagine there's a real push now to come up with vaccines that are indicated for pregnancy.
Yeah, was that an and or an or? They had to meet.
It was either or.
Either or, okay.
But also a push to, because, for instance, the COVID vaccine, even though it was only licensed for those aged 16 and up, had it been licensed for 18 and up, it couldn't have gone on the childhood schedule. But Pfizer was clever. They had gotten it, licensed for 16 and up, so they got the ACIP to vote which is the CDC Advisory Committee, to vote to put it on the childhood schedule for 16 and 17-year-olds, and that means it's now on its way to getting that liability waiver.
Yeah, that's there's a lot of maneuvering there, I can see, to hit that requirement. Because what company wouldn't want indemnity for their product?
Right. So the problem for us, the American taxpayer and vaccinee, is that now, because the manufacturers do not have liability for these products in general, they've gotten rid of 99.9% of liability, they can produce things without effective safety testing or efficacy testing. So a lot of vaccines now get licensed on the basis of, well, this vaccine causes antibodies to be developed in the person who's vaccinated. But you don't have to prove that those antibodies are going to protect you from disease.
Oh, you don't. You
Yeah.
can patent something as a vaccine, even though it doesn't actually make you impervious to the disease.
Well, look at COVID vaccines. Both,
Right.
right?
They were sold as giving you immunity.
But in fact, they never promised to prevent you from getting infected or from spreading infection. They were very, 'cause I watched all the FDA advisory committee meetings that went through and authorized and then licensed all the COVID vaccines. And so it was made very clear by Pfizer that in fact it had not, the vaccine had not prevented infection and spread in monkeys.
Yeah, that's another thing that's, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons all of us are so confused, is because the media says one thing, but the actual official pronouncements say something
Are different,
entirely
correct.
different. And it's, I think people, understandably, mostly listen to the media. They're not listening to the committee meetings like you are. So they have higher expectations.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I mean, the media has certainly failed us. All they've given us is fake information since the start of this pandemic. I mean, certainly before there was a lot of fake information, but now, nothing regarding COVID is reliable, or masks, or vaccines. And they're happy to change their story frequently and without any explanation.
They do, and they often, I follow the headline email from the New York Times, and I'm just sort of shocked at how they're actually deliberately sowing confusion, in my opinion. They say one thing one
I
day.
share your opinion. I actually think that I didn't think this until recently, but I think that is part of the strategy to control us, is that no matter how smart you are or knowledgeable you are, they're throwing all these contradictory bits of information at you. So it's almost impossible to pick through them. And it leaves everybody, from academic to anybody else, just sort of befuddled. And your brain can't grasp the information. You don't, I hate to say it, but I can, because I have this sort of unusual background in biological warfare and medicine and biology. I sort of, having been a doctor for 40 years, I kind of know what is bullshit and what isn't in the medical field. And I know a lot of biological warfare history, so I know where what's true and what's false there. And so I've managed to pick through it, I think, in a reasonable way. But it would be impossible if I hadn't had that background.
And just to give you one example from a recent New York Times headline email, they said, we can't tell what's going on with the cases. Here are some graphs from, Amy Wu. No reference of who Amy Wu is, where the data came from, nothing. It's just, here's some, there's like four graphs in red from Amy Wu, and you're supposed to look at those and believe that they are actually telling somebody something about what's going on. But, on what basis would you even believe that they were true? So it just seemed like they were putting out basically, anything just to have a news story and make people even more confused.
Exactly.
Let's talk about a little bit about the war for people's minds, because it seems like that's what's going on. You mentioned earlier, you know, how anti-vax is a pejorative, and breakthrough cases is a euphemism for vaccine failure. There's so much of that going on. But I think some of the really important ones are how official organizations that are supposed to look out for the safety of Americans and the world population. Maybe you could talk about how they've actually changed the language about vaccines and, you know, how we set certain bars or standards for safety over the years. I think it's happened in the last of, you know, 15 or 10 years that they've changed some very important definitions in regards to safety of these drugs.
So it seems to me that what has been happening, and I don't know when it started, is that people who have been moved into positions of authority in federal agencies and at the WHO and the UN, whose job it is to implement policies, and in order to do that, you need fake data. And so CDC is probably the worst, the easiest one to pick apart in the U.S., because I know they've been doing this for over 20 years, because I started working on anthrax vaccine back in 1997 and looking closely at their data, and I found so many different things they were able to do to screw around with the data and get the result they wanted. And they've been doing that ever since. So I'll give you a bunch of examples. One example is, how many people die of flu every year? CDC routinely would say 48,000. Sometimes they'd say 36,000. They claimed it was 80,000 when we had the 3 or 4 years ago, we had a particularly bad flu. It killed more people than for about 20 years. And so they said 80,000. But then there was a year where there was hardly anybody died. And in fact, the swine flu, the year 2009, fewer people were dying than usual from that flu. And so, well, how do they come up with these numbers? It turns out they're not real numbers. Oh. CDC collects all death certificates in the United States. So they know how many people died. They know, you know, you can't bury someone without CDC having a copy of a death certificate. But instead of collating that information and providing it to the public, they create models. And they create very complicated models, and they don't tell you how they create them. They tell you part of it. They'll say, well, we used this algorithm, or we used this method. Wow. But then they tweak it a little. It's not quite right. They don't tell you exactly how they got their controls and their subjects. And they come up with this bogus data. So anyway, it turns out when you look at death certificates, how many people did the doctor think the flu killed them in the United States and put it on the death certificate as the cause of death?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was only about 2,000 a year. And in that year when we had a lot, about 3 or 4 years ago, it was 6,515 death certificates. It's really hard to find that number. You really have to pour through a lot of data and charts to come up with that number. It took a long time.
Do you have to do it state by state because the feds aren't collating?
In some cases, you do. So if you want to find out how many people have been dying of narcotic overdoses,
mm-hmm.
CDC will not tell you. The New York Times went state by state to get that information a couple of years ago, and they came up with a number of 60-something thousand.
Wow.
But no, CDC doesn't want you to know. And so even when you try to look, you go on their tables and find numbers. Most of the numbers you're looking at are modeled numbers.
Is that right?
Not raw data.
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay, but that's not the only thing they do. They do a whole lot of other things. So, for example, CDC obviously wanted to say these vaccines work very well. So they did not want the so-called breakthrough cases, or as I termed them more correctly, vaccine failures. So in April, they must have realized they were having too many of these vaccine failures, and they changed the way they wanted them reported. The CDC, although it collects all the death certificates, it also collects a lot of other information from states, from cities, from territories, and sometimes directly from hospitals. But it's different in every state. And sometimes it's different from county to county or whatever. So CDC has made sure not to standardize any of this. CDC gives a lot of grants. This year, they have over $15 billion budget.
Wow.
And about $5 billion goes to purchase vaccines for the Vaccines for Children program in the United States, which pays for about half the vaccines or a little bit more that American children get.
So
all the Medicare, Medicaid vaccines, plus Indian Health Service and other groups.
Okay.
Okay. And then they have a $10 billion budget, and a lot of that money goes to grants to the states and for various projects. So they dole out, you know, it's like Fauci controlling, you know, biomedical research.
Mm-hmm.
The CDC controls what data the states collect and report to CDC. And so even though they have this billions of dollars a year that they can dole out and easily require standardization of the numbers that CDC is collecting, they never have.
Hmm.
And then they blame the states. Whenever Congress wants a number and CDC can't get it, they say, well, the states, you know, didn't give it to them, or it was collected differently in the different states, so we don't know what it means. Anyway, let me go back to April.
Yeah.
All right, they decided they needed fewer of these breakthrough cases. So they said, okay, now you can only report the cases to us if the patient died or was hospitalized. Otherwise, we don't want to know about it. And we're going to make sure that they really have COVID, so they have to have an extremely highly positive PCR test. It has to require 28 or less cycles to be reported to us as a breakthrough case. Now, that's very interesting, because everybody else who was having a case of COVID, they could be reported to CDC if they had a cycle threshold of 40 or 45. But for the breakthroughs, it had to be under 28.
Can you explain why that's significant?
Yeah, so basically, you have to have a whole lot more virus in your nasal passages in order to meet that cycle threshold of 28. Whereas there's lots of false positives, very few false positives with a cycle threshold of 28, but many more when you allow more and more cycles to be. It's very nuancy to explain, but the CDC has made it so they recommend that this test be performed in such a way that it will invariably pick up junk,
yeah,
and count it as positive tests.
Right.
But that doesn't happen very much for the breakthrough cases.
So one way to look at that is that your viral load, how much of the virus you actually have in you, determines how sick you are probably and how easy it is for you to spread it. And the more cycles you do in the test, the more likely you'll exaggerate that viral load.
Yes, and it may not be virus at all.
Oh, right. That's true, too. Yeah. So they've basically rigged the test so that the vaccinated people look like they haven't broken through.
Right, and the unvaccinated, you know, can have lots of false positives.
Yes.
So it makes it look like, oh, well, you know, then they say 99.5% of people in the hospital are unvaccinated. And you say, how can that be when in Israel, 60% of the people in the hospital are vaccinated, in the hospital for COVID. And in England, same thing, 60% of the people in the hospital with COVID were vaccinated.
Yeah.
How come in the U.S. it's only half of 1%? Well, it's because they fudged the data.
So they've been diagnosed with something else. They may be in the hospital, and they may be very...
What can I say? It's this whole... They were also lying, actually.
Okay.
So it wasn't 0.5%.
That's a simple term.
I mean, yeah. having fudged it in all these different ways,
yeah.
they still had to lie when okay. push came to shove.
Yeah, because I know some people go to the hospital and they may have something else entirely wrong with them, but if they, and they may have
that's
no,
another thing.
They
right.
may have so, no symptoms of respiratory
yes.
illness, but they'll be diagnosed as having COVID because the PCR test was cycled high.
Right. Well, so how CCDC wants to be on the right side of the law as possible, and they have lots of lawyers working for them. So if you go to the website and try to figure out, well, how many people of this age have COVID or died from COVID or whatever, they don't say died from COVID. They said died with COVID.
Ah.
So here in the U.S., the CDC says, oh, about 400 kids have died, almost 400 kids have died with COVID. Or what they use another term, what is it? Involving COVID.
Oh, yeah. That sounds
involving COVID.
More incriminating.
And, but it was I couldn't believe it. In Germany, a couple of months ago, they said only 20 kids have died from COVID. And in the UK, they said under 30 kids. This is up to age 18 have died of COVID. This is another thing CDC has done. Kids are different ages in different states. So in some states, you can be a kid up to age 20.
You're kidding.
Some states up to, no, I'm not kidding.
Wow.
They have so many ways to make it impossible to compare things and use their data to make sense of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It is crazy. It reminds me of, you know, people making fun of third world countries for things like that.
Exactly. Exactly. And these were done deliberately.
I would think. It seems like. Why else would they happen?
Mm-hmm.
And we're almost, we've only gotten about 9 or 10 minutes left. And I was wondering if you might address your perception of your fellow doctors, how they're behaving throughout this pandemic and the bind they find themselves in. And also, it's because the media seems to be driving this so much with the public. Your perception of the media and why it's definitely taking the stand it's taking, politicizing this healthcare crisis and basically keeping everybody in a very high state of alarm.
What I want to say is, okay, there's a virus here. It's potentially life-threatening. It has killed Americans. We don't know how many died of COVID and how many died involving COVID. It's killed mostly elderly, but certainly has killed younger people.
What would you say is the overall survival rate, Doc?
Well, it varies by age. So there is no real overall survival rate because we don't know how many cases there are. Again, FDA and CDC don't allow us to use any antibody tests or T-cell tests to diagnose immunity. If we had a reliable test and they let us use it, we could figure out how many people have had mild or asymptomatic cases and already are immune, how many have had it, and then we could probably figure out what the death rate was and what what the other rates are.
I see.
But we don't know that because they're not giving. So FDA allows Pfizer to use antibody tests to identify among all the people that are subjects in their trials how many have gotten COVID in the past, you know, who's gotten COVID, and okay, you're not going to be counted in the vaccine group, right, because, you know, we're not going to make you a vaccine subject because you're already immune. So FDA has no problems approving Pfizer to use those antibody tests to diagnose immunity in potential subjects for their trials, but refuses to let a single American do the same thing.
That's odd.
No, it's not odd. They want everybody vaccinated. They don't want you to be able to prove you're immune.
Okay.
And so that, from that alone, you can see that this whole program is not up for your health. If it was for your health, we would vaccinate the appropriate people. You know, leave the ones who are already immune have better immunity than the vaccine can convey. So you potentially can damage that immunity with vaccinations, and you're certainly not going to improve it. So despite what some of these idiots at the CDC have to say, you know, you don't improve on natural, you know, if you've had measles, we don't vaccinate you for measles. We don't vaccinate you for anything you've had except possibly pertussis. You know, there are most infections, you know, once you've had it, you're immune for a while, and the more serious the infection, you know, the longer you're going to be immune. Mm. So in any event, so they don't want you to be able to prove you're immune. They want everyone vaccinated. And then you have to say, well, why do they want everyone vaccinated? Why do they want to throw all these healthcare workers and teachers and policemen and firemen out of work because they won't get vaccinated when many of them are already immune? What is that about?
It's a good question.
It's some kind of other agenda. I can't say what it is, but it's some kind of frightening agenda. And then you say from there, what the hell is in the vaccines? And, you know, I don't know how to investigate a vaccine. I don't have the tools to identify if there's any contaminants or any material in there that shouldn't be there. And very few people do. You have to do a number of tests requiring very expensive equipment. So I think, given everything else that's shady about this whole process, you have to say, what is the vaccine agenda? And we don't know, but we should be suspicious. And anyone who has the ability to investigate more in terms of what is in the vaccines that are being offered, well, that would be a good thing.
We'll talk a little bit in the few minutes we have left of the VAERS system, the adverse event. What's that VAERS stand for?
Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System.
Yeah.
So thank you for bringing it up. It was instituted again 30 years ago after the Vaccine Injury Act was passed in 86. And anybody can report. If your friend was injured or killed by what you think was a vaccine, you can report it, and FDA and CDC jointly run this system and are supposed to investigate all deaths and serious injuries. Of course, that doesn't happen, but that is the requirement.
Mm-hmm.
What's been remarkable this year is that there have been more reports to VAERS of deaths in 6 months for the COVID vaccines than all the deaths reported in the 30 years of this program.
Wow.
So there were about 8,000 deaths reported over 30 years. And since December 14th, when they started vaccinating people with the Pfizer vaccine and then added Moderna a week later and added Johnson & Johnson 2 months later, there have been now about 14,000 reports to VAERS of people who have died shortly after a vaccination, most of them within a week after vaccination.
And they're not even counted as vaccine deaths if they happen after a certain time. Is that correct?
This is another problem with the way these things have been defined. So you're defined as fully vaccinated a week or 2 weeks after a dose, your second dose of Pfizer and Moderna. And so if you die within a week of your first or second dose, you're counted as unvaccinated.
Wow. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Right. And so our federal agencies have ignored the fact that we have this enormous, there are more reports of all injuries from 6 months of the COVID vaccines than there were for 30 years before, just about.
And just for a reference point, how many deaths did it take in previous vaccine campaigns to halt the deployment of the vaccine?
So the one people point to is the 1976 swine flu, where they had about 40 deaths and stopped the vaccination program after 45 million doses had been given. And that's useful to look at, but remember, they didn't have any swine flu, so there was no disease. People were being vaccinated for a possible future disease.
Yeah.
That never eventuated. There was a vaccine given, an oral vaccine that was for rotavirus that was given to babies in 1999. It was available for less than a year. It caused a telescoping of the intestines in children that often required surgery to be fixed. And So somewhere over a million doses of these, or children, had received rotavirus vaccines, and they had seen this problem even in the pre-licensure trials. And then they saw more of it, and they quickly jumped on it. And I think that vaccine was available for about 9 months and was stopped. But the problem is when you give a lot of people a vaccine in a very compressed period of time, as has happened now, you completely miss all the long-term side effects. So we see anaphylaxis is occurring, it seems, about 50 to 100 times more than average with other vaccines. The American Academy of Allergy, you know, has said you should not give this vaccine anywhere where you can't do a resuscitation, because people can stop breathing when they get it. There's a high rate of acute severe allergy. Mm. So there are many problems, but for whatever reason, whether the federal agencies have been told, I imagine they were told to ignore them, or whether they've chosen to ignore them because of who's running these agencies. These people were handpicked to take orders and carry them out. We've had such an enormous number of side effects. And so that's bad, but at least adults get to choose whether they want to be vaccinated or not. But now we're going after children. So the vaccine's been authorized for 5 to 11-year-olds, and Pfizer wants to go for a license for them soon. Pfizer is going after an authorization for 5 to 11-year-olds or a license. And soon, right now, it's been only given to children, legally given to children, down to the age of 12. But we've given it to 12, 13, 14, 15-year-olds. And something that has never been done before, to my knowledge, is our U.S. government and other governments and state governments and local municipalities are allowing 12 to 15-year-olds to consent for themselves. They don't require parental consent. Parent doesn't have to be there. You don't need to sign a piece of paper from a parent. You just go in and say you want a vaccine, and the vaccinating person says, okay, I think this person can consent, and that's it.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
It's against the law, but it was a policy that got rolled out. I haven't seen the documents that explained how it would work. But I've collected documents from four different cities that they're advertising, where they tell kids you can come in and you don't need parental consent. And a friend of mine contacted one of these agencies in a large U.S. city and had someone email back and forth pretending to be a 12-year-old whose parent didn't want them to get the vaccine. And this health department employee told the child how to go get it around the back of their parents.
Yeah, that just seems completely immoral.
Yeah, it is, and evil, because the parent doesn't know if the kid's gotten it. The kid might wind up getting extra doses, or, you know, if the kid comes down with an injury, they don't know what caused it. It's a disaster.
Yeah, it's just so crazy. Dr. Merrill Nass, I'm afraid we're out of time, or just about out of time. Do you have any final words for people listening? A lot of people are still worried about catching COVID one of its variants.
So this is the other thing that tells you that our governments are doing something terrible to us, because they have suppressed the use of hydroxychloroquine with an antibiotic and zinc, or ivermectin. They both work quite well against COVID. These are remarkably good antiviral drugs. And in fact, the federal CDC published a paper in 2005 talking about the benefits of chloroquine on the first SARS virus. Mm-hmm. And the NIAID, Fauci's group, published a paper in 2014 mentioning the benefits for MERS, which is another deadly coronavirus, of a number of drugs, which included chloroquine. And yet these agencies pretend this never happened. People have published papers in Europe as well on the efficacy of these drugs for COVID and for other viruses. But we are not allowed to prescribe them. over 30 states issued restrictions on the use of hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine last year in March to 2020, at the start of the pandemic. In my state, I am allowed to prescribe it, but only after a person gets sick with COVID. I can't prescribe it the day before for them. And now ivermectin, which turned out this year to be very useful, somehow there's a supply shortage, and none of the pharmacies can get it, except the compounding pharmacies still have some access. So very difficult, if not impossible, for most people to get drugs that will turn this disease, if you take the medicine early, you have to take it within the first few days, it'll turn this into a much milder disease. You generally don't get into the late stage of thrombosis, cytokine storm, etc., if you take these antiviral drugs early, and yet our government is stopping us from doing that, stopping doctors from doing that, and somehow they've managed to sort of get the AMA and some of the boards, the medicine boards, mine, the American Board of Internal Medicine, mm-hmm. you know, they sign these letters to doctors saying this stuff doesn't work, you know, you're a quack, and then at least three states have gone after the licenses of doctors who prescribe these medications for COVID. Now, this is insane. I mean, these are safe medicines. Most of the world, they're, you know, in the third world, these are over-the-counter drugs.
Right. Yeah.
And Merck, for example, has donated over 3 billion doses of ivermectin to Africans to prevent river blindness. And then Merck comes out on its websites and said it's not been adequately safety tested. Well, if it wasn't adequately safety tested, why did you donate 3 billion doses?
I know. None of this makes... It doesn't make any sense unless they're actually trying to harm people.
Yeah. So I think that there were many policies that were going to be rolled out under the guise of the pandemic. Many things were happening. You know, we're moving more into digital currency, digital, you know, vaccine passports, more 5 and 6G. And people have been so, you know, wound up dealing with the pandemic that they haven't sufficiently seen that maybe this pandemic was prolonged, deliberately prolonged, while these policies are being rolled out quite quietly.
Yeah, and I imagine, you know, if I've, you know, read that we're being, or they're trying to move us to a more Asian style or Chinese style social credit system, mm-hmm. and that the vaccine passport
could be used,
first
you
step
need something
towards
like
that.
Like a vaccine passport in order to do that.
Yeah, and for people
also, you can automatically, you know, grab taxes out of people if you're controlling their funds, you know.
That's right, with the centralized thing. Digital banking, yeah, which I think they're also moving towards. So all this stuff mm-hmm. is very alarming, but I think, you know, if people realize it's coming or that this is in the works, perhaps we can stop it if we work together.
Exactly. And I would urge, don't quit your job. Wait to be fired. You know, your bosses want people to quit. You won't be eligible for unemployment, probably, if you quit. We're pushing, the Children's Health Defenses and other organizations have filed a number of lawsuits to try to stop these mandates and the vaccine passports, et cetera. And so try to hang on as long as you can, and let's all join together and fight this new form of tyranny that is being imposed on us very quietly.
Merle Nass, thanks so much for coming on the show today, Politics and Science, and really appreciate your point of view.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
The preceding show presented the viewpoints of its participants and did not necessarily represent an official viewpoint of WMRW or its license holder, RootsWork, nor did it present medical advice. I've been your host, John Barkhausen. Please tune in again next week for another edition of Politics and Science.